All right, we're still at Splash 2011. We have Grace Program Language Designers, two of them anyway, Andrew Black and James Noble. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Good to be here, Charles.
Great. So tell us a little bit about Grace, sort of give us some information about it.
We're designing it. It's not done. It's primarily focused on teaching object-oriented programming.
Okay.
So it's designed to appeal to instructors and students in the first 2 years of a programming curriculum at university.
Okay.
And that's something we know a little bit about because we're both professors, and so is Kim Bruce, the other key designer.
Excellent. So one of the questions I would ask them right off the bat is, how would you define object-oriented programming? That's a fun one.
Well, you know, one good definition, I forget where this was, is the customer objects and you go and do some programming.
Excellent.
I think I would say it's programming where objects are the main structuring mechanism in your programs.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a wide range of object-oriented languages from, you know, things like Smalltalk right over to things like C#.
Sure.
And I think it's important that students get a good grounding in programming. You know, increasingly that these are the kind of languages that they're going to be using when people enter their professional careers.
Yes.
There's a lot of object-oriented code around that people are going to have to deal with, and it's important to get a good introduction and a good grounding in these kind of things.
Certainly. I guess where I was kind of going at being at this programming language geek festival is this sort of notion of like abstract data types versus like the interface approach that we're all well aware of. That's kind of what I meant in terms of like, how do you make that the object-oriented model understandable to people who haven't come at it before?
Well, obviously the thing you say to new programmers who've never programmed before in their first week is that this is all about co-algebras. Right? I mean, no, you don't do that. But you talk about, and in fact you probably don't start in the first week with objects at all. You probably just start with numbers and don't introduce objects to a little bit later.
Okay.
But we're not trying to dictate a particular programming pedagogy and you have to do it in this order. We're trying to make Grace appeal to all the instructors out there who are interested in teaching objects with a variety of different methods. I actually personally really like the how to design programs approach that was pioneered in Scheme by Matthias Verleissen and his people, and I've taught out of that book. And once you've done some simple numerical problems, they give you word problems where they say that you've got this data sitting there in the world, and there's three different kinds of it, and you're going to do these operations on it, and you design data structures and operations on them.
Okay.
What's missing is there's no way in Scheme to encapsulate those and say these operations, what they would call functions, only apply to this kind of data. And that's exactly what objects give you. So it seems to be a very natural extension of that very much proven and tried approach of starting with having the data drive the design.
Interesting. So right off the bat then I'll ask is, there's a lot of object-oriented programming languages out there that are general purpose and very high level. So C#, JavaScript, Smalltalk. Why did you create a new language for specifically teaching this concept?
Well, I think the main reason we're doing it is that there are a lot of languages out there now, certainly. But many of them are really starting to show their age. So if you think about, and again, this is primarily aimed at computer science majors, people who are going to be doing programming. The language that are typically taught there is, of course, Java, which is at least 15 years old. I mean, that's 15 years is from its public release. Or C#, which is about 5 years younger, but is still an old established language. And I like to think that the field's moved on somewhat in those 10 to 15 years, and arguably C# has moved with the field perhaps more than Java has. But, you know, there are still a number of places in C#, and I think most of us are all aware of them, design decisions which almost make the language just more complicated. There's more stuff in it than it needs to be. I mean, C#, once you've added in link, and now it's got dynamic types in a way and closures, it's a very big language. And we think there are advantages in getting a smaller language, perhaps having some of the stuff these days that aren't necessarily important so much to focus on early while people are learning, put those into libraries or off to the side. And so the core of the language can focus on the most important ideas that people need to learn when they're starting programming.
Excellent.
And that's one of our goals.
Cool. And so what are some of these specific things that you've added to the language, that you're adding to the language, because it's not done yet, as you mentioned? What are some of these constructs?
I would think the most important things are things that aren't in the language rather than stuff we've added.
Okay.
Just to thinking about, say, Java, which has accumulated a lot of features that professional programmers maybe really need, mm-hmm. There's a lot of things we don't have. We don't have overloading of names, or we don't have checked exceptions. We don't have many different kinds of number of different lengths and sizes. Mm. We don't have statics, yeah, and there are some things that worked out really well. The separation of interfaces and classes in Java, I think, has worked out well, and we're probably carrying that a little bit further in Grace.
Okay.
We don't have characters; we just have strings. Right? So as a computer scientist, you probably know, I can put a character in a particular byte, so I want that to be something separate. But to the ordinary person out there on the street, you know, you have strings of one character and strings of three characters, and they're all the same. You can mix them around.
Sure.
So, and many other languages do that. And it just simplifies those critical first few weeks when you don't want to frighten students away.
Sure. Excellent. Now, speaking of frightening students away, I do know that you guys have an unsound type system, or I wouldn't say that, that's more Dart, but you know what I mean. So in other words, you've employed optional types. That's what I meant. So
the type system that we're looking at for Grace, I like to say it's got kind of four things to it.
Okay.
So I like to say it's structural. It's gradual, it's optional, and it's dynamic by default.
Interesting.
So, is it sound?
Well, yes, and it's sound.
I'm sorry.
And I know that that does seem a very, very, 2010 kind of approach in programming language design.
Come on, man.
I mean, it's quite clear that Bertrand Meyer was right after all. So let me just talk about what this means. The structural type system means that, if you like, a simple way of thinking is that the types describe the outside of the objects, not their insides. Mm. So as perhaps in Java or C#, a type is an interface. It's the list of method requests that an object can answer. That's basically it.
Okay.
Any object that provides those methods can be a member of all the types of the methods that it provides. Mm. You don't have to explicitly implement an interface. Mm. And there's a number of reasons for this. It makes it easier to work with frameworks or to work with other code, which, again, is something that actually happens quite often in early courses. People don't have to say it implements all this sort of stuff. The gradual part means that, as well as the type system, which is sound, if your program passes the type checker, it will guarantee that certain kinds of errors don't happen.
Okay.
Again, this is something else that we know for instructors is very important, for at least some instructors taking this approach. But gradual also means there's this effectively a hole in the type system, so you can write type code and turn it off in various places by type dynamic, and that again is something that Dart has. Mm-hmm. But again, Dart has a whole bunch of other things that means the type system as a whole doesn't give you any guarantees.
Yes.
The third one of these, something Andrew is particularly keen on, is optional. Which means that there can be a big switch on your IDE. It's not clear every implementation has to support this, which will mean you can run the program even though it's got type errors, actual type errors, as a way for students basically to find out why the types are there in the first place.
Sure.
So, if you get a type error and you say, I don't believe it, you can run the code, and if you try and add 3 to an integer or to a string somewhere in your program, you can get an error message that comes up and says, I really can't add 3 to a cucumber object. I just can't. And no amount of persuading.
Well, you can in JavaScript.
Well, you can in JavaScript.
You get cucumber 3.
Right. You get cucumber 3. this is another reason why JavaScript and languages like JavaScript are not generally stuff that kind of programs who want to prepare the next generation of professional software engineers are going to start with.
Sure.
But there is something about JavaScript and there is something about Python that's important, which is the fourth thing, dynamic by default. So if you don't put any type information in your program at all, it will run quite happily with the type system switched on, but every type will be treated just like dynamic is in C Sharp today. And you know, the fact that C Sharp has this was actually one of the inspiration of thinking perhaps there's more space we can push on that a bit in language design. And the reason why we think that's important for pedagogy is we know a whole lot of people, we tried this at my university, who would like to start out with something like JavaScript or perhaps Python that doesn't have types in it, Visual Basic, and run dynamically, that's easy to get started with, and then add the types in as people get more adapted, get more used to programming, and they're going to get more benefit from the types rather than it just being something else that beginning people have to find.
Okay.
And a key advantage there over what a lot of people do, starting off in Python either for the first half semester or the first semester and then switching, is you're able to introduce types and people only have to learn about the types. They don't also have to learn a new syntax, a new semantics, and a new set of libraries, and probably a new IDE as well, which is happens if you say you start with Alice and transition to Java, or Python and transition to Java.
Okay.
And that idea that we're trying to decouple things so that different structures, different pedagogies can teach, you know, particular features of the language, particular programming skills when it's appropriate for them and makes sense for their students, rather than, you know, in order to be able to use the Java collection libraries, you have to teach the difference between floating point and integer numerics right up front on day one. You have to teach what public static void main means. We used to have to teach people that they have to bow down to the compiler and type this stuff in before their first program can work. And having something which is easy to get involved in, you know, print hello world is pretty much print hello world, but it's still got, you know, the power of a programming language that can grow with people as they carry on in their education.
Excellent.
That was a long rant, wasn't it?
It was.
Well, that rants are good.
But you're known for those.
So, do you guys have interfaces?
Yeah.
Of course.
They're called types.
This is called types. Okay. So, let's talk about that. Now, do you have mixins? That's probably not a...
No. So...
Too complicated.
So the current proposal is we have conventional inheritance.
Okay.
Because that's something that most instructors will want to teach.
Okay.
Now, you probably know I was one of the people who co-invented a thing called traits, which is something you can argue as an alternative to inheritance. That's not in there either.
Right?
It's not at this point a mainstream feature.
Okay.
Maybe it will be available as an add-on at some high level of the language.
Okay.
Something important we didn't talk about yet is a good idea we've taken from the Dr. Racket people is a notion of language levels. Mm. So there's sort of a beginning student language,
okay.
And then that which doesn't have a lot of features, and then you add some more features in and you get sort of an intermediate student. And we're not exactly sure which features go in which level, but we're very committed to having different levels. So it may be that extensions get put in at a higher level for experts or for instructors writing libraries that aren't accessible to students.
Okay. So now for the beginning level, there seems to be a lot of ceremony in object-oriented programming. So it seems, and what I mean by that is, it seems like if you look at the people who don't really understand programming at all, JavaScript's a great language for that because it hides a lot of its complexity and its dynamism and things that it just works. And it's like, wow, I didn't know it would do that. So, but I know you're trying to teach people a structured way of thinking about things. And so you've chosen the object-oriented approach as you've already discussed. So for level zero, the very first level, what do people get?
So we haven't, in fact, sat down to figure out what's in which level.
But
I agree with you that it's whatever concepts you want to introduce first, you want to do it without a lot of superstructure.
Yes.
So as James said, print, quote, hello world, quote, is, in fact, a program that runs, and it does what you would expect.
Sure.
If you want to create a single object, you say object, open curly brace. What goes in an object? Well, data and methods. You write the data definitions, you write the methods, you close the curly brace, that's an object.
Okay.
Right? And you don't have to do anything more than that. Oh, you want to name it? Well, then you say def x equals that structure. Now it's got a name.
Okay.
So you can, we hope that you can build this up piece at a time and you're not introducing a lot more than you need. We've also taken to using words like, introducing things like methods with words like method.
Good.
So that
It's a method, guys. It's
right,
a method.
So one of the things that it's sometimes hard for students to do is learn the vocabulary that lets them talk to other professionals. Mm. One way you can help that is actually using full words in the program. If they have to write the word method, they'll learn this is a method.
Sure.
If it's just a blank space and it's inferred that this is a method by the context, then they may never learn the term.
Understood.
So it also makes it easier for tools. If the word's missing, you can say, you either have to say def for a constant or var for a variable or method. You can't just write an expression there. It's not meaningful. So hopefully we can get good error messages.
Okay.
But this is in a very, the implementation's a very early stage.
Understood. And are you guys teaching the basic concepts? I mean, encapsulation, polymorphism, that the stuff we throw around when we talk about object-oriented programming languages, which is what I meant by interfaces, the sort of the contractual guarantees of implementing an interface that then inherits through your types.
Sure, very much so.
Okay.
So, you know, we'll have objects, individual objects will be able to be encapsulated. Some of the methods can only be requested from on an object itself.
Okay.
And yeah, we're going to call self rather than this. And this is because if you're pointing to an object and you say this object, well,
sure.
Which one do I, that one?
And so one important place the encapsulation comes in is that if you want to access a variable or a constant inside an object, you just request it by name. And it doesn't matter whether that value is calculated in a method or is stored directly in a variable or a constant. Mm. You just use its name. And so you can redo the implementation without having to change the code in the client.
Okay.
And this is another example of one of the things we're trying to do in Grace. I mean, that's not a particularly new idea. It was there in Eiffel and Trellis and Self back in about 86, 87. But this means that with only basically having, well, variable constant declarations and methods, and not having to add anything more, you can basically do all the kind of coding patterns you might be used to with attributes, with getters and setters in C#, and I think Dart has those as well. Mm. So Grace doesn't need to have that because this is an advantage, I guess, of adhering very well, strongly to the basic OO model. Everything that happens because you request that some object does something. Mm. We can express all those things without actually having to add more constructs into the language.
Okay.
And in some sense, as much as coming up with new things, part of this is about just looking for simplicities, looking for generalities in the existing language, and then clearing other stuff out of the way so that there's, you know, more space for people to learn and perhaps, you know, later on experiment with libraries or other ways of extending the language.
Sure. Now, one of the things I would ask, since you're training people to become object-oriented professional engineers, software engineers, I mean, most of what they're going to be doing is manipulating data and data structures, right? So how do you have a link-like thing for, so how do you manifest to Grace developers that they can iterate over a collection of data? I mean, how?
Well, there's two separate questions there.
There's two,
one is,
yes,
how do you get hold of a collection of data? And the other is, how do you iterate over it? So you iterate over it very simply. You send the collection a message just as you would in Smalltalk. The message takes a lambda expression, essentially, a block as argument, and that's the body of the loop.
Okay.
So you can write your own control structures over your own data structures.
Mm. Which of course you can do in C#, and is how link is implemented. So, you know, there's a question. But in Grace, all the iteration is done that way.
Okay.
So again, this is a case of us taking a feature that some people might think is advanced, or a feature that's making its way into languages like C# a couple of years ago and Java a couple of years to come, and saying, okay, if we carefully choose this feature, then there's a bunch of other stuff that we don't have to include in the language. So, you know, we hope to have link-like queries for databases, but then all data access will be done that way, and so that means there's a bunch of earlier approaches that we don't have to support.
So what do you tell the students when they ask you what a lambda function is?
Well, we don't tell them what a lambda function is. When you start, you show example loops, and students write similar loops, and they look very much like loops in any other language. The syntax is a little bit different.
Okay.
Later on, when you show them how those libraries are implemented, they see this is actually nothing more than a method, and they can write their own methods like that.
Awesome.
So you kind of build up gradually. You don't want to lie to students. You don't have to tell them the whole truth, because that would be a mistake.
Right. So one of the things that Dart does here is that our lambda expressions or our blocks are in some sense follows Ruby. They're written with curly braces.
Mm-hmm.
And then everywhere you might use curly braces, pretty much in C# or in Java, surround blocks of code, well, those things are simply blocks, which are our lambda expressions. So, it's the fact that people will actually start writing code that can be thought of as using closures from day one.
Interesting.
But that code is not going to be any more difficult to write or think about than the code that you'd have to if you started on C# or Python.
Nice.
And, there's this other example of being careful about the choice of features so that you can give a nice smooth ramp. It's not like suddenly you hit a wall and say, oh no, I want to do link, I've got to do something different. Oh, I want to do scary closures, I've got to do something different.
Yeah.
Careful features and decoupling features from each other so that particular schools or particular people or particular textbooks can sort of choose a path, their own path through the language, without being committed that, okay, well, if I want to call this library, I have to make sure that everybody understands the difference between floats and doubles and longs, and in Java, the difference between, boxed and unboxed, and all this other kind of stuff. And there are those kind of details in lots of languages, and trying to separate stuff. And we're not going to be perfect, but that's certainly one of the things we're trying to do.
Great. Good. I hope it's successful. I mean, it's an interesting thing to do.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So let me ask you one quick question. I mean, what is it about Eiffel, since you mentioned Bertrand Meyer, that isn't a good teaching tool? Or what do you think it has that will confuse students wanting to learn how to join in programming right off the bat? Because it's so heavily...
Bertrand Meyer is there, and Eiffel did a great job. And if you can compare it to some of the other things, if you compare it, say, to the state of C++ back in 1986, clearly Bertrand Meyer's made some prescient choices, and other languages have evolved to follow him. And apparently Dart, and with its covariant typing. But again, Eiffel, I think, has got a lot of marks of when it was originally designed. So its inheritance hierarchies, it's actually more complicated than traits, but it's done with classes. So you've got multiple inheritance, you've got repeated inheritance, you've got embedded attributes versus standard attributes. A lot of the terminology of Eiffel, in fact, is very odd and off-putting. So you either have to learn to speak not just the Eiffel language, but you say attribute instead of field and all this.
Sure.
There's a bunch of stuff there, and there are some things we're taking from Eiffel. Mm-hmm. So, certainly we're going to have assertions, probably pre and post conditions, very much like Eiffel does, and for the reasons that you want those kind of things.
Yeah.
But then, the idea of Eiffel, the idea of giving a gentle ramp into things, it's probably fair to say, isn't really evident in Eiffel's design. It's tight, it's hardcore, it's everything from day one.
Sure.
And we think we can get people to the same place, but with a smoother RAM.
Excellent.
I mean, Eiffel is an industrial strength language. Mm-hmm. It's used for real systems in life-critical applications in some places. And the design constraints that gives you are rather different from the ones where this is an introductory language for beginning students.
Sure. That's great. Well, I look forward to seeing where this goes. And I noticed that it is, as you said, it's a work in progress. And you guys have a website, I'm assuming, that people can follow, and a blog as well?
Yep. So the website, the blog, is on gracelang.org.
Yes.
gracelang.org.
There'll be a link on this for that.
Excellent. And the other thing, which in fact we haven't mentioned, is this is very much an open process. It's not just the two of us, or rather the three of us, keeping the design, keeping it secret, and doing something on our own.
Sure.
We're very much open. The evolving language specifications published on that website. There's a blog that you're welcome to visit. And if you've got thoughts on our design, we really want feedback, want people to contribute.
Great.
We're trying to do this as much an open source, if you like, approach as possible. The specs and stuff will be made available under open source licenses and all these kind of things. Because really, a language is about more than just learning. It's also about building a community of speakers or community of people who will read and write that language.
Absolutely.
And it can't be just us if it's going to be successful, and it won't be. In as much as it succeeds, it'll be because a community of people who are teaching, learning, and writing these sort of programs see something of value in the idea of having this sort of, you know, development as the next language along.
Excellent. Well, hey, great to meet you guys. Thanks for coming aboard.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Good luck with you. Keep it up.
Cheers. Okay.
And now, listen, I'm going to have to ask this before you leave. Tell me a little bit about the Splash Conference. Like, have you been enjoying it? How long have you been coming? I mean, you're on the committee.
I was at the first UPSLA in Portland in 1986,
nice.
Presenting a language called Emerald. So I've been doing language design for a long time as well. And Splash has changed a lot. UPSLA changed a lot. And now it sort of blossomed when object orientation became the big new thing in industry, and there were tutorials and thousands of attendees. Mm. And now sort of OOO has won. You know, why would you come to UPSLA? So that's sort of the evolution, is that it's now trying to become the programming conference. Mm-hmm. And I've really enjoyed this one. It seems to have a great buzz. There's lots of things going on. There's mm-hmm. lots of great people here. Mm-hmm. It just feels like an exciting place to be.
Absolutely.
So I think we're doing a pretty good job.
Oh, absolutely. I highly recommend this. And again, it would be nice to see even... I talked to this with William Cook today about this, the sense of... kind of a merged conference where you have the theoreticians and designer and academics, and also the engineers. And I mean that only the real world engineers, the people who write code.
Yeah, there's a lot of good industrial participation, and there's a track trying to encourage that.
Yes.
And I think it's good from both sides. You know, I like talking to people who've got real applications, and they can tell me why my ideas don't actually work in practice. And I've certainly spoken to people from industry who want to see, you know, what the latest thoughts on the theoretical side are, what's going on with types, not because they're going to be doing it next week, but, you know, 5 years from now they may, and they want to know what's coming down the road.
Absolutely.
So I think it's good to have this sort of environment.
It's great.
And it's great to have it in Portland, because everyone likes UPSLA in Portland.
It's great.
The third time it's been here.
Nice.
Yeah, I was going to say that because I don't actually live in Portland, and Andrew might not want to blow his own trumpet, but it's been lovely. You know, we're going down to the river this evening. You know, it's just about a 10-minute walk to Powell's World of Books, the best technical bookshop in the U.S.
or nice.
Potentially the world. Lovely place. People are friendly outside, inside. And, UPSLA is, or Splash, I suppose, we have to learn to call it. You know, in some ways it's really the best-kept secret. Mm. There are not just academic language designers, but there are designers of C# and Java and F# and X10 and other languages you haven't heard of, but as Andrew said, you probably will in the next few years.
Yes.
A lot of them are here, and there are a lot of programmers who I guess are thinking, okay, well, you know, I'm a bit further ahead for going to, you know, TechEd or whatever the Oracle world is, and I'm thinking more about what they're doing, and it's a great place to come. So,
absolutely, man.
Maybe we'll see you again next year.
Yeah, I hope so. It's really nice to be here as Channel 9, and we love this stuff, and I know our Channel 9 viewers do. And we also have a lot of viewers out there who are becoming introductory level. You know, we hope to attract more of those people, and we're going to be doing beginning C# stuff. So it kind of would be nice to be able to point them to the basics of object orientation before you get into syntactic specifics in a big industrial strength language, as you were talking about. So. Nice work,
great.
Guys.
Cheers, Chuck.
Cheers. Sure.